wait. Let's see whether Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, wow, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to the bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs were all open. Many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went to the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Let's pray. God, thank you so much for being present with us, for being a magnificent God that we can worship, that we know cannot be contained within a box. God, I thank you for allowing us to stand here and praise your name, to lift up your name. God, I thank you for allowing me to hold your word and to speak your word. I know that we are not worthy of you, but you have called us to be worthy. God, I thank you that you've put us in this place. I thank you that you've allowed me to be in this place, but I take it with humility. Knowing that my words do nothing, I pray that you will give me your words. I know that my thoughts are nothing. I pray that you will give me your thoughts. I pray you will open up our ears so that we hear you speak, because you are the teacher. I pray you will make our hearts supple and ready to respond to what it is that you have to say. God, move us today. Change us so that we will never be the same again. It's in Christ's name I pray. Amen. So I lived in Japan for about 4 years. And my wife laughs whenever I tell this story. It's a long story. I will save you the length of it. But the gist of it, it takes place in a church, and in one of the Japanese churches. And I was talking about someone's favorite food. And the phrase, the word that came into question was the word rori. And so I asked him what was his favorite food. What was his favorite rori, rori's food? And he looked at me and he questioned. He didn't understand what I was saying. And finally, after about 10 minutes of repeating the word, doing this little dance that you do when you're learning a language, they finally figured out what I was saying. And they said, "Oh, no, rori." I said, "Right, rori." And they said, "No, rori." I said, "Right, rori." And they said, "No, rori." Am I missing something? Is something being lost in translation? I'm watching their mouth. I'm like, I'm not getting this. Rory. Rory. I didn't get it. Do y'all hear the difference? Good. That means I'm not insane. So the idea was that I wasn't giving it long enough O in the Rory. Rory. But the Japanese language is the third fastest on the planet. You don't have time to. Anyway, it really staggered the imagination that they couldn't figure out Rory when it should have been Rory. So, you know, we have problems with words, and we do the same thing in English, you know, affect and effect. You know, does everybody know how to use affect and effect? You know, I sometimes, just when I'm writing something that I know somebody's going to read, I always go back and check just to make sure that I'm affecting the right effect. So, you know, we have these things. King's English sometimes changes. The word prevent used to mean allow. Now it means to stop from allowing. The word that we're going to look at today that has really messed up a lot of people in the church is the word wherefore. Probably the most popular wherefore is Act 2, Scene 2, Line 20. Y'all are laughing. Line 22? Something, 12? Line something? Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? Right, exactly. And she asks, she continues to go on and ask the question, you know, give up the name so that you'll no longer be known by that name, because I want to marry you. She's looking for, she said, and if you won't drop it, then I'll no longer be a Capulet. She's looking for, so the word wherefore, which means something in the future, you know, show the purpose for why you are by that name. Show me that purpose. And drop that name so that we can be married, looking in the future. This word wherefore, which is one of those words that was properly translated in the King James. We don't use it anymore. It's gone. And the closest thing we have is not where. The closest thing we have has been used to say why. But put that into King's English. What, it just doesn't sound right, does it? Romeo, Romeo, why are you Romeo? You know, that's not why she's... Obviously, you're named Romeo because that's your family name. That's not what she was saying. She was saying, you know, looking into the future, there's something that's keeping us apart. This is the word that I want to look at. When the words come out of his mouth, he says, in the old language, he says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which is, my God, wherefore hast thou forsaken me? Obviously, we dropped that because it just doesn't sound right in our language anymore. And now it says, why? But the problem is that with that why, our ears and our mind draws up a question. Why did you do that to me? So I don't know how many times I've heard this passage preached, and it always caused me to have a question in my mind. Can this possibly be right? Can Jesus really be hanging up on the cross saying, why have you done this? And that's the way it's always preached. My God, why have you forsaken me? There's usually tears from the preacher, right? Why have you forsaken me? I don't understand. Wait a second. From all eternity, he knew this was going to happen. How can someone who knew from all eternity this was going to happen, who voluntarily gave his life, say, why are you forsaking me? I don't understand. If you are God, if he is God, how can he possibly say, why are you forsaking me? Is he going schizophrenic on the cross? Has he dropped his godhood? See, that's where typically the sermon goes. He is no longer God. He is now man. It's the man part coming out of him saying, why? I didn't sign up for this. I thought it was going to be better. I thought I was going to leave before I died. No, he came to die. He came to be crucified. He told everybody, the Son of Man's going to be crucified on the cross. They're going to treat him horribly. They're going to beat him. And I'm going to die on the cross. He knew this was going to happen. So this passage always bugged me. How can he possibly be saying why? Well, he's not. He's saying wherefore. All right, now it may not sound like a big difference, but I want us to see what difference that makes. And once you see this, I pray it does the same thing to you that it did to me, because immediately the passage makes utter sense. Whenever you take out the why and you put it in a wherefore, which we don't use. But anyway, we're going to walk through this passage. Now, what he was doing is very simple. He was what they call marking a passage. The Jews would always mark passages. They would say the first line of a psalm, and then you were supposed to know the rest of the psalm, because if you were a good synagogue boy, you knew all the psalms. So the psalm that we just sang starts off how? And they would automatically know the next passage, the next line. Let me give you an example. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound. Good. All right. See, y'all got it. I just marked the passage. All right. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early? Okay. So y'all know how to mark a passage. Good. All right. That's what he's doing. He says, Eli, Eli, la box of money. So he's saying this, he's marking this passage. Now, if they were good synagogue people, they should have known what was coming next. Now, what was he doing? Go to Psalm 22. All right, I want you to see something in Psalm 22. I want you to see exactly how poor of synagogue people they were. Okay, if you're in Psalm 22, which is the big book in the middle, Psalm 22 starts off how? How? Why have you forsaken me? The same passage. Now, is Jesus up there asking a question? My God, why have you forsaken me? Why? No. He's singing a praise song up on the cross. Are you kidding me? How bad can we misunderstand what he was doing? He's not crying in torment. He's singing a song. Is that not great? This is not a sad Jesus. This is a happy Jesus. Now he's tired. His lips are stuck together. He's dehydrated. He can't form sentences. He's hanging so he can't breathe, so he can't sing. That's why in Mark, in the other passage, you know that he keeps on murmuring something. You know what he's murmuring? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? He keeps on singing the song. Now, you say, well, why is he singing that song? That doesn't have a hip beat. I'm not hearing any guitars and drums beating in the background. It's not helping me out any. I can't sing to it. Well, I'm glad you asked. I want you to read. Okay, so you see the very first verse, right? My God, why have you forsaken me? He's marking that passage. Now skip down to verse 7.
All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. Now tell me what they said when they were mocking him. He's crying for Elijah. Let's see if he's going to rescue him. See, this is one of the most prophetic psalms in all of the psalms. He's saying, if you would just open up your eyes and sing this psalm like you know it should be saying, you would understand why I am here. Jesus is not looking back. He wants to prove a point by being on the cross singing a praise song. He says, if you will sing this song, you'll see it. And sure enough, verses 7 and 8 is the first part. So 7 and 8, you see, he says, y'all, this is what y'all are going to do. Now, this is a very sad psalm. I'll go ahead and read some of it. He says, I'll start back in verse 3. Yet you are holy, enthroned and on the praises of Israel. In you our Father trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. Which is a picture of what Jesus was on the cross. Then this, verses 7 and 8, which I read. Verse 9. Yet you are he who took me from my womb. You made me trust at my mother's breast. On you was I cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. Many bulls encompass me. Strong bulls of Bashan surround me. They open wide their mouths at me like a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. This sounds like a depressing passage, right? This is what Jesus should be saying. He's in torment up on the cross. For dogs encompass me. Gentiles were known as dogs. A company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. This is exactly what had happened to Jesus. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. How much more predictive and prophetic can this passage possibly be of what happened to Jesus on the cross? He's not crying in torment. He's saying, look at the scriptures. They speak and testify of me. That's what he's saying. Sad, sad psalm, isn't it? No. Verse 19. But you, O Lord, do not be far off. Oh, you my help, come quickly to my aid. Deliver my soul from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dog. And then, in verse 21, everything turns around. Save me from the mouth of the lion. And then he screams, you have rescued me from the horns of the wild oxen. And then he goes on and he continues to praise because the victory has come. See, this is not a sad psalm. It is a victorious psalm of what happens when God interdicts into time and changes something. See, whenever this was written, this is my situation. This is what's bad. God, prove yourself to be real. And by verse 21, everything turns around so that God is exalted. Now, what is Jesus doing? He's saying, look at the passage in Psalm 22. If you can understand the passage, if you sing that psalm, you will see me up here on this cross. You've pierced my hands and my feet. You're gambling for my clothing. You're asking if God's going to save me. All these things are predictive and true. And if you look, you will see, but they failed. They took themselves out of the relationship with God to kill this man. They took them out of a position where they would look and see, this is what God's doing. And they said, we're sacrificing him. We're crucifying him. I want us to look at something. They failed spiritually. They failed biblically. They failed musically. They failed. I don't want us to fail, because what ends up happening, if you look at this passage, is a, why am I here, oh God? You will follow that path into blasphemy and heresy, because you have to say at that point, either Jesus is not God, he was man, he laid down his humanity, something to the fact that God did not die. Jesus was not the perfect sacrifice that ended up dying, because a man died on that cross. There's been probably millions of people have died on a cross, and none of them had a perfect sacrifice to cleanse me from my unrighteousness. Jesus, as God, a perfect soul, he's the one that made that sacrifice, and it had to be him on the cross. It could not be just a man. You will walk down the wrong path if you have yourself asking why. What he did was ask wherefore. Now let me walk through this so we can see what we're talking about. And I hate doing this because it's one of the things I say, I teach people, preachers, that they should not do, but we're going to do it anyway. All right? So on this board, you're going to see two words, two main words, and the words are medulla and lemma. Yeah, lemma and medulla. All right, so there's two major words for what we would translate as why in the Hebrew language. The first one is medulla. Medulla means, here I am standing at this point, and I'm looking back, and I'm saying, why am I here? Why am I here? Why did you put me here? It is our typical idea of why. It's a point backward word, saying, I'm looking back, why am I here? I don't understand it. I don't understand why am I here. What made it so that I got to this position? That's not what Jesus said. If Jesus would have said, Eli, Eli, medulla sabachthani, we'd be in trouble because he'd be saying why. He'd say, I don't understand it. I don't get it. This is not what we'd planned on. He did not say medulla. He said lama. Lama means something different. It's a point forward word. That's why they separated them. Looking back, looking forward. Lama looks forward. He says, wherefore, i.e., demonstrate the reason for me being in this place at this time. Starting from where I am right now, show the purpose for why I'm here. Huge difference, isn't it? Demonstrate the purpose for why I'm here. That's what lama means. Now, let me give you the impact that makes into this passage. Eli, Eli, my God, my God. Demonstrate the purpose for me being on the cross. Demonstrate the purpose for me standing here being forsaken in myself. Demonstrate. Do something. Show why I am here. Not why am I here. Show me something. That's what he's asking. Man, it's so simple after that, isn't it? So now we're going to back up. Now we got some context, and I know that was a long context. But now that we have some context and we understand briefly the idea of lama, meaning point forward, show the purpose, now we're going to go back into the passage and we're going to develop with that in mind. Okay? So here's what we're going to look at. We're going to look at first that man attempts to rely on his own understanding. Verse 47 says, they say, oh, let's not, maybe he's crying for Elijah. See, they misunderstood so much that the Eli, Eli, which in the Aramaic would be Eloi, Eloi, they thought he was calling for Elijah. He wasn't calling for Elijah at all. He was saying, my God, because he was quoting that passage. But they misunderstood him. See, they were hanging him because they thought he was a danger to their religion. He wasn't the danger. He was the answer. He wasn't the one that would persecute their sin. He was the one that was going to forgive their sin. He wasn't going to enslave them. He was going to redeem them. They completely misunderstood him because they thought he was going to be something bad for who they were. Jesus is not something bad for who you are. He's something good for who you are. They misunderstood him completely. Completely. If you look in Matthew chapter 16, you'll see another point of misunderstanding. Jesus asked his disciples, who do the people that aren't here with us, who do they say that I am? And the answer came back and said, well, you are Elijah, or you're Jeremiah, or you're one of the prophets, you're John the Baptist, you're somebody else, a good teacher. This is the misunderstanding that was present then. That is the misunderstanding that is present now. Some people still, to this day, misunderstand Jesus here in a place where the Bible is supposedly well known. Who is Jesus? Well, he was a good guy. He was a miracle worker. He was a teacher. He was a guru. He started a new religion. You know, you have all these things. He was a good guy? Okay, wait a second. If he was a good guy and he told all these lies about himself, he couldn't have been good because he lied. He was, you know, there's a famous phrase, he was either liar, lunatic, or Lord. Either he is a liar because he lied about everything, he was crazy so you can't accuse him for being a liar, or he is who he says he was, and he was Lord. He's not a good teacher. He's not a good man. We misunderstand those things. He's not someone who looks at you when you sin and go, that was bad. Mm-mm-mm. Go and serve for 40 hours, otherwise I'm going to punish you. He doesn't look at you and say, oh, you did that 5 years ago and I will not forgive you because it made me mad. He's not going to do it. That's not who he is. Jesus is the one that says, I took your sin already. I'm just waiting for you to ask forgiveness because it's already been taken care of. See, that sin that you're thinking of, he already forgave it. He's just asking for you to ask. Jesus is still misunderstood to this day. Don't fall into the trap that they fell into. They didn't know who he was. They didn't misunderstand him. Please understand him. He's not the prosecutorial Jesus. He's not going to point fingers and say, you. He says, I took it. Come. Make sure that you understand who he is. I don't want you to misunderstand him. So let's get to what God did here. Okay, Jesus cries out and says, God, demonstrate the purpose for which I am sitting here being forsaken. Show me why. What happens? The veil was torn from top to bottom. We talked about this. I don't need to go back through that. Now, he tore it from the top to the bottom. What was he signifying? He's signifying a lot. For one, religiosity was completely naked. What was supposed to be behind that veil? Anybody know? Yes. Yes. The Ark of the Covenant was supposed to be there because that was the Holy of Holies. What was behind there?
Nothing.
Because it had been lost. It was gone. There was nothing there. Don't pay any attention to the lack of the Ark of the Covenant behind the curtain. You know, there was nothing there. It was void. It was gone. They showed how naked religion can be. Have you ever felt naked whenever you're in religion? Whenever you say, oh, I, this shame comes upon you because you've done these things and you're judging, you feel like people are judging you. Maybe people are judging you. And you're judging yourself and you feel like you're exposed, completely exposed. That's what God did to his own religion. He pulled down the veil and said, you know what's exposed here? There's nothing here. There's nothing here. And matter of fact, since you weren't allowed to come into this Holy of Holies, I'm now tearing down the veil and allowing you to come in. You know what Hebrews says? Hebrews says that you can approach the throne of grace with confidence. With confidence, you can go before God. The veil was torn down to say you are welcome in this house. The veil was torn down to say there's nothing in religion, it's only in relationship. The veil was torn down because the law that was represented in that Holy of Holies was now answered. Jesus said, I did not come to destroy the law, but rather to fulfill it. And what he said at the very end of his death was tetelestai, which is, it is finished, the law is done. There is nothing else to be accomplished. What good would the Ark of the Covenant be? Nothing. Why is it gone? Because he knew it was going to be nothing. Because Jesus had answered it. It was all done. The law had been accomplished. The sacrifice was accepted. And we now have direct access to him. Direct access is so powerful. Prayer. All I have left to do in my life now is pray. Everything else is gone, but now all I can do is pray. Right? It's so powerful. Don't think that all you have to do is pray. It's the most powerful thing that we have because you're directly involved with one who wrote all the rules of the universe. Now, politically correct or not, it is a truth that whenever you call for support on your router, you get routed to India. All right? So, and I have a lot of Indian friends. I'm not poking fun. However, I always find it interesting if I have an internet problem and I get routed to someone who's obviously from India, and he says his name is John, or Bob, or, you know, I want to talk to someone who knows that. No, I don't want to talk to someone who's reading the script, which is the priest. I want to talk to someone who knows the equipment. I want direct access to someone who knows something. I don't want to talk to a priest. You don't have to talk to a priest. That's why this happened. God said, "You want me to show you why? You want me to show you why you're being forsaken at this moment? You want to show them why?" Bam! Now, you people have direct access to God, the Almighty, the Creator, the Omniscient One. You have direct access. The law is done. Don't fall prey to religiosity. Understand that we have relationship. That's just the first part. What else has happened here? Death is defeated. Look at verse 52. The people, you know, we already talked about this. People came out of their graves. Death is defeated. You no longer have to fear death. Don't let it control you. Don't think that you're going to be constrained by the things that death does, because there is a resurrection that will come. There is a resurrection. Death relinquishes into resurrection. Death relinquishes its hold on people. So death is defeated. That is another answer that he gives. You want to know why you're being forsaken? The veil of the temple is torn and all that stuff. Then death has now been defeated. How's that for an answer? What else did he say? If you continue on the passage, he says, there's a passage here. It says in verse 54, the centurion says, when the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, truly, this was the Son of God.
My God, demonstrate the purpose for which I'm here.
The law is accomplished. Death is defeated. You are divinity and salvation has come. There's a proclamation from someone who had been so far away from Jewish nature, so far away from salvation. For heaven's sake, he just killed the Lord. But yet he proclaims, surely, this was the Son of God. Why? Because of all those things that had just happened that he saw. So what Jesus requested is working. Demonstrate the purpose for me being here. Immediate salvation, right there. Deity is pronounced upon God. Upon Jesus, and salvation now comes to the Gentile. Now, I don't want to skip over this too quickly because I am so thankful about that last part. Salvation has come to the Gentile. Up until that point, we did not have much of a chance. At that moment, when the Gentile looks up, and he sees what happens. You see that salvation now comes. What did Jesus tell all the disciples when they were going out to the villages? Do not go to the children, to the lost people. Only go to the children of Israel. Don't go outside of the children of Israel. What's the very first thing that's told to them after that? Go ye into all the world. Start here in Jerusalem, go to Judea, go to Samaria, but then go to the uttermost parts of the world. See, before the death, before this request for demonstration, it was only for Israel. But after the death, it's for everybody. Salvation has now come. Deity is pronounced. Salvation has come. The eyes of the Gentile are open. Reconciliation is now available for all people. And salvation is now promised by his life. Well, what else? Well, I'm going to back up a little bit. I'm going to back up to verse 46. Because the last little piece is that light was restored. If you notice, it says, up until the ninth hour. Okay? Up until the ninth hour, it was dark. From the sixth hour to the ninth hour, darkness fell on the land. From the sixth hour to the ninth hour. This happened at the ninth hour. Whenever he died, it was the ninth hour. Upon his death, He proclaims, he says, God, demonstrate the purpose for which I am on this cross. God says, Bam. You can now enter my presence. Bam. The law has been answered. Bam. Relationship is key, not religiosity. Bam. Death is defeated. Bam. Jesus is God. Bam. Salvation is for the world. And then, the light comes back. Light came back. During this death time, it was dark. Now, what happens when you live in the dark? You live in the dark, you stumble, you trip. You're not confident about anything. You feel lost. It doesn't matter if you're in your own house, you're lost. You can't walk. What happens in the light? You can see wonderful glowing faces. You don't trip over obvious things. Jesus constantly says, calls himself the light. John calls Jesus the light over and over and over again. Here's my question. Light was restored at the ninth hour because Jesus said, demonstrate the purpose for me being here. And light came back. Are you living in the darkness between the sixth hour and the ninth hour? Are you living in that darkness, in that period where you say, I don't know who he is? I thought he was just a man that died up there because he said, why am I here? Are you living in that darkness? Stumbling around life? Not being able to enjoy the fruit of the relationship that he offers?
Don't let yourself be trapped in that 3-hour segment of time. Understand that at the death of Christ, light came to the earth. Salvation was offered to all. If you just come, it doesn't matter what had happened in your past. It doesn't matter if you killed somebody. It doesn't matter if you committed adultery. It doesn't matter what you've done. You could have killed Jesus himself. That's what these guys did. And in truth, whenever your sins are mounted upon him, that's what you did. And he doesn't care. The reason he died was because of that. Don't live in the dark. Don't allow Satan that part of your life. Because Jesus wants you to live in light. That psalm that he was singing was not a sad psalm. It was a psalm of victory. I'm sure if he could have possibly made a smile, he would have been smiling. Because he knew it was over. He knew that he had won. He knew that the thing that had been planned for all of eternity was now accomplished. And that's what he said. It is finished. I've paid it. It's done. I have won the victory. And now that victory is available to us. It's not something to be sad about. It's not something to be mad about. It's not something to frown about. It's not something to cry, oh God, why? It's not something to cry about. It is a gift that has been given to us. So please, whenever you approach this passage, understand that he is crying out in victory and offering you a position with him. I have a passage that I have posted here. It's in Luke. Come on, yeah, keep on. There, one more. This is Luke 18. But the tax collector, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. I tell you, this man went away to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. Understand that Jesus doesn't care what you've done. It's just that he wants you to come to him. Don't live in the dark. Enjoy the light. And enjoy the victory that he has for us. Jesus is still, to this day, asking the same demonstration. God, keep on demonstrating. Bring more people to faith in me. He's still saying the same thing. If you are still in the dark, please understand that you have no possibility to relieve sin within yourself. You have no power to do it by your own. You're just going to walk in the dark. That's not what he wants you to do. If you try to make your own possibility of salvation happen, you'll be going to an empty Ark of the Covenant. You're going to go to an empty Holy of Holies, and you're going to find nothing because you don't have the possibility. It's not available to you at all to save yourself. But he's not stingy with it. He says, here it is. Grace is already done. All you have to do is come. I'm going to ask you all to come on up. As we sing this last song, the altar is open. I'm up here. If you want to talk, if you want to take care of business at your chair, if you want to take care of business up here at the altar, whatever it is that you need to do, please do it knowing that God welcomes you. He went to the cross not questioning his purpose, but wanting to demonstrate it and show it to you today in this place.